A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you. Danielle Paradis, contributing editor here at Canada Land.
Chelsea Brown.
Today, Danny, we're going to talk about the year of the Glaives. Terry Glavin takes his best shot at the national reckoning over residential school grave discoveries. Also, why journalism is bad for you. Not you, dear listener. No, this job is harmful to us, journalists, says a new study on mental health in the media. Welcome once again to Shortcuts, Danny, where we talk shit about the news.
Happy to be here.
This episode is brought to everybody by Cody Yang, Jessica Sturm, Bill Reed Fraser, Cassandra Clayman, Colleen Bryant, Max Lupo, Mick Fagan, and Dustin.
Hi, I'm Dustin. I live on Langara Island in British Columbia, and I am a marine technician. I support Canada Land because I really enjoy how Jesse tries to find journalists with first-hand knowledge and experience of the issues that they are talking about.
Danny, I don't know about you, but I kind of knew that this was coming. I sensed that something like this was coming. It was only a matter of time, you know, before somebody took a big swing at Canada's year of reckoning over the discoveries of graves at residential school sites. I'm not claiming to be Nostradamus here. Was this something that you kind of anticipated as well?
I don't think that I anticipated it would come so quickly. So that was a little bit of a surprise. I first read the New York Post piece.
Biggest fake news story in Canada. Kamloops mass grave debunked by academics, by Dana Kennedy.
And that wasn't really surprising. I mean, you have the usual suspects that they're talking about. Well, they were missing Conrad Black, so that's a shame. You could have had, like, the Holy Trinity. It was a conservative-leaning American news site. They might feel like they can cover things in a way that other people can't or don't. But I was very surprised to see Terry Glavin in the National Post.
Yeah, we'll return to the National Post piece. You know, starting where you started with this New York Post story, that one's a lot, I think, easier to deal with because it's just so disgusting and demonstrably false. when you have an article where, you know, like, yes, to those of us who are familiar with these people, to hear, you know, Tom Flanagan and Frances Whittleson, the people that are rounded up here are like, yeah, these are the deniers. And they're saying, and they're genocide deniers, and they are explicitly denying genocide. And there's just a lack of information. The reader for the New York Post would not know that it's been established and accepted, and it's in the TRC commission's findings that cultural genocide was practiced. Instead, you have people just saying they use a lot of words like cultural genocide. Riard, an academic, is quoted, tells the Post, if that's true, there should be excavations. Everything is kept vague. Canadians feel guilty, so they keep quiet. You know, just explicitly this idea that it is owed to Canadians that communities dig up the remains of their ancestors, of children. Otherwise, they must be lying. Like, it's just here, plain as day. It's a fake news story. It's being debunked. There's no room given for a very thoroughly researched historical record in the New York Post piece. It's a lie. The New York Post piece is a lie.
You're right. This is a much easier piece to start with because it is a lie. But it's a lie that will go far for those who found this difficult to stomach. It's probably quite soothing to hear people who are called academics or people who are called experts that they are able to talk about, oh, well, here's the things that we never really talk about. And there's a really interesting piece in The Star by KJ McCusker talking about the last stage of genocide being denial. And I thought that was a really compelling point to make at this 1 year anniversary of Kamloops.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that kind of feeds into why I feel like I knew this was coming. As a consensus grew across Canada, this national consensus of like shame and grief and shock, and as the news traveled further, you know, out of Canada into the US to the Vatican, it seemed more and more likely to me that it was just a matter of time before somebody would pop up to play devil's advocate and to go into that denial, to kick off a backlash and try to debunk the whole thing. Like that's the lifespan of this. And I noticed some of those usual suspects kind of like nibbling at the edges of the consensus, sort of like picking away at little points. And as always, there are going to be, you know, the little errors in reporting or substantial ones. You know, I think it is worth correcting that the term mass grave was bandied about quite, you know, liberally, when in fact most of these were not mass graves. Using those details to cast the wider thing into disrepute. But the atmosphere was not welcoming for those contrarian, edgy voices. They were coming from the crankier fringes of people who like are also on the record saying deplorable racist things. So I kind of felt like when the time is right, we're going to see this mainstreamed. We're going to see this laundered, you know? And, you know, it's one thing in the New York Post where people are less familiar, the readership is less familiar. Like, you can kind of get away with things that I think we would clock as showing your ass with racism. Like, they close with an anecdote from Thompson Highway, a full-blood Cree, as a well-known Canadian composer, author, and pianist. He's now 70. So they found somebody who's willing to say, residential schools are great. He said, my oldest brother was illiterate, and I went because my father wanted me to, and the education I got there set me up for life. So this is sort of an argument that we won't hear in mainstream Canadian discourse anymore, because like the fact that there are some people who had that experience, and they're certainly, their experience is their experience, and their account is legitimate. But like, what does that mean, or how does that debunk or discredit other people who we know died there? One does not have anything to do really with the other. I don't think you could write that in a Canadian newspaper.
No, I don't think that you could. And it's true, like there are people who don't have stories of abuse, and I think they're entitled to their stories as much as anybody else. At the same time, like you've said, it's not what we're talking about. So in the middle of people talking about tragic experiences, sexual abuse, neglect, death, is it really the time to then come in and take up space and go, well, I had a really great experience? Like, that seems actually very just insensitive to your own people.
Yeah. And, you know, from a purely journalistic point of view, to select that voice and exclude the others is to mislead and misinform your readers. And the New York Post's very wide, you know, readership, you know, of this right-wing tabloid. But, you know, nevertheless, they've been told a very simple story that this whole thing is debunked. And that is a lie. What we saw in the National Post is a little bit more complicated to parse.
Yes.
It was clear enough to a lot of readers who read Terry Glavin's piece, The Year of the Graves, How the World's Media Got It Wrong on Residential School Graves. To many readers, indigenous readers, among them people who follow this topic, some academics, this was very easy to dismiss as a piece of straight up genocide denial. Those thoughts are being shared, you know, on social media and elsewhere, that that's what this piece was. And it was residential school denial. But to the general readership of the National Post, I think that it's not so clear. Because if you read the piece, Terry Glavin says explicitly that what was practiced at residential schools was the application of cultural genocide. And he states explicitly he is not a residential school denier. And what this article purports to do, and what Terry Glavin, I think, is telling the world is, this is not my opinion. This is reporting. This is facts. I'm relying on what indigenous leaders said. I'm relying on a historical record. He has a long history of covering these things quite extensively. And he is saying, like, if you have a problem with this, that's about your beliefs or your feelings, but this is the truth, what I'm writing here. And I'm not denying genocide. I am criticizing the media coverage. I'm criticizing the government's response. I'm criticizing the public's response with facts. And I think if you are a general reader of the National Post, that might wash for you. And then when you read other people saying, well, this is clearly an act of residential school denial and genocide denial, I think you might be very confused. And in an instance like this, with a piece that is complicated and very long, and at times to me pretty murky, like, Danny, like, either on Shortcuts, I could invite somebody on and we could go through it and try to figure it out. Or there are occasions where, like, what I actually want to do is talk to the author and say, this assertion of fact here, this conclusion you reached, how did you get here? I'm not sure you've provided enough evidence for this. Like, how do you know this? This seems very suggestive and insinuating over here. What are you suggesting? What are you insinuating? Can I understand where you're coming from here? There's a fair amount of rhetoric and hyperbole in the piece that does not seem consistent with reporting and seems more like it's coming from an opinion piece. I want to ask about that too. So my practice here, and, like, I, you know, hopefully the service that this show could provide, you know, the Monday show Canada Land, like, I've asked Terry Glavin to come on to that show for an accountability interview where I can simply ask him about what he wrote and subject this piece of writing to scrutiny. And he's agreed to do that. And that is where my troubles began. Often, Danny, when I book somebody for an accountability interview, I will, like, announce that I've done so, because sometimes people back out of accountability interviews and I find they're less likely to back out once it's known that they're coming on the show. And when I announced that Terry Glavin was going to come on the show, there was a very, very strong response to that, which I know you caught a bit of.
Yeah, people were not very happy with you when you made that announcement.
Yeah. And I think that's worth discussing too. And, like, just to kind of lay, you know, some kind of ground rules out for this, like, I did not want to discuss this with you because, like, I'm seeking your permission to interview Terry Glavin. That's not this exercise. I want to talk to you about the dynamics of the resistance to me interviewing him, because they're complicated and they're interesting and they're worth discussing to me. There are two points of view on whether an interview like this should happen. And they both kind of seem to be, like, reasonable and legitimate to me. One, I think, has to do with me being the person to do the interview. And I certainly heard this, that should we have two white guys going through this and discussing this when it is such a personal issue and it is something that people have experiential knowledge of and greater understanding of than I do? And is that appropriate? And perhaps it is not. On the other hand, there is an argument that why should it be the job of indigenous journalists or indigenous voices every time somebody dusts off one of these pieces and dusts off their argument and decides of their own volition, the National Post and, you know, Terry Glavin decide that they are going to go and take a shot at whatever it is that he's taking a shot at, the labor and the exercise of whether it's about reasserting a historical record or fighting or pleading for one's own humanity, that that job should not always fall to indigenous journalists and voices, and that there is a role for white or settler journalists to come and, like, kind of take care of our own and shoulder some of that labor. And it is a role that I have, like, felt like I could be useful in the past. And it's played out that way in the past. So those are the tensions of like that we're trying to balance or figure out. And I wanted to get your take on. I'm curious what you think about those kind of like, I don't know. I heard both of those arguments being made by one, by, you know, Jesse Wente was critical of our decision and asked me to reconsider. And he kind of voiced both of those different arguments. And I'm trying to figure out like, well, then what do we do? Do we just leave this thing unanswered on the front page of the flagship newspaper of the biggest newspaper chain in Canada?
Yeah, there's a lot there. First, I think Jesse Wente was coming from a completely different argument, and that's that it is painful for survivors or children of survivors to hear about residential schools. Like, it's a horrible topic to have to see revisited. And that's not on you, but that is what inevitably the discussion ends up being about, is parsing the differences in sexual assaults or death, or if somebody died in a residential school, or if they died of tuberculosis versus neglect. And that's something that Indigenous communities across Canada have been dealing with for a year, since Kamloops, but really since the founding of what we call Canada. So we have 150 years of people denying the experiences of Indigenous communities, denying the deaths, covering up the abuse, refusing to share the records. And add on the New York Post article this week, there's a feeling in the communities that there's not ever the ability to rest or heal or not be forced to have this dialogue on a national stage. And that is painful. And I think that's what Jesse Wente was alluding to. Now, when we talk about journalism, when it comes to interviewing controversial figures, that is the job, right? You're right in that it wouldn't be what listeners expect of you, what I expect of you, to just not talk about this for this week. Like, say, would this shortcuts be enough? I don't think it is. I think we do need to explore the impulse to whitewash or soften what happened at residential schools. So I think what's important to keep in mind is that, like, survivors and children of survivors and people who are affected by the legacy of residential schools are listening. And it's tiresome to be a part of a community where, like, your oppression is debated all the time. And that's where I think a lot of those responses to you were coming from. It's pain and trauma and anger at never having any space to heal. Like, imagine somebody burst into your family funeral and started demanding to talk about how the person died. Have we seen medical records? How do we know they died this way? That's kind of what it is akin to.
Yeah. And I think it would be entirely inappropriate for me to like try to like swoop in on a white horse. I will reassert the historical record, and I don't know that I could do a very good job of that. Like, I can do a close read of a piece of media, you know? I can ask reporters questions about their copy. And I think that because journalism and reporting is being used as a tool to assert an argument, if there's any value I can provide, it's to apply journalism to that, you know? And I think it would be arrogant to the extreme of me to say, like, that is more important than these people telling me, you know, you're harming people by having this conversation. Like, I hear those voices and I don't dismiss that. The question of, like, is this doing more harm than good is alive and a real one. If nothing else, I think that, like, the position is to absorb and, like, listen to all that and, you know, struggle through it and talk about it, because that's not a choice that, like, a lot of Indigenous people have as to whether or not, as you say, it's hell. Like, I at least can understand that, to not have any power over whether these things get dredged up again and again, or who's talking, or, like, just the, like, how inhumane a lot of this is, to not have any control over who's representing your most intimate and painful history, memories, familial issues. Like, all this stuff is lived today through intergenerational issues. Like, it's, there's no, like, half getting into this stuff. Like, if you're going to take it on, I think you have to take it on and make a long-term commitment to it and be serious about it. I'm trying to.
Yeah. What I would want to ask Terry would be, what is the point of this piece? I don't understand. Like, it's ostensibly media criticism, but there's these phrases throughout his piece where he talks about the psychosis that came over people this summer with toppling statues and canceling Canada Day, and simultaneously mad about, oh, we've known this forever, but also, why are we talking about it now? And what do you think, like, in our short attention span that we have as readers and news consumers, like, what do you think people are supposed to get out of this piece? And is it reasonable to expect that communities in a year, which is no time at all in the history of residential schools, in a year that they would have made the decision to exhume or not exhume, why would we expect communities to prove to us what happened when there's already archival records, which, as I mentioned, we've still been fighting for access to those. The Vatican hopefully will be releasing records soon, but they've been less than forthcoming. There's a book that was written in the 1990s from John S. Milloy, mm-hmm. and it's called The National Crime, and he's white. It's like a foundational reading if you're trying to understand the history of residential schools. So I guess I do see a place for settlers when it comes to uncovering this information, when it comes to discussing this information. But not everybody is going to feel comfortable with that. I mean, you know, I was thinking back to like the last time you got in trouble, and you and I talked about this, maybe not the last time, but the most recent time that is closest to this in relevance, Tara Henley. Mm-hmm. And we're dealing with somebody different here. Tara Henley had been on Fox News, which has millions and millions of listeners. Like, it was absurd to think about how you talking to her could spread her information any further. But it was also, I mean, she was talking about cancel culture, like whining about not having enough space. And it was entertaining then to hear her challenged. Now, when it comes to this conversation with Terry, I don't want that to be entertainment. I don't want that. Like, maybe a takedown would feel good, but it also feels like using survivors as like football in a match between two journalists.
Yeah, I remember a quote that Emily Nicolas told me in similar dynamics of like, it feels like a hockey game where black people are the puck, where you get these types of dynamics. I mean, the Tara Henley, and to remind listeners, that was the former CBC employee who left and wrote a piece about how it's diversity is making CBC too woke, and she, you know, spoke out against their hiring practices and articles about queer identity amongst the Filipino culture and language, and this was the problem with the CBC. It was a similar dynamic in that when I announced that I would be interviewing her, people said, why are you platforming a racist, et cetera, et cetera. And ultimately, I think that that was a worthwhile thing to do. I do think the dynamics here are different because the stakes are much higher. We're talking about genocide. And I agree with you, like, this is not an exhibition. This is not about entertainment. And Terry Glavin is not Tara Henley. So I will ask him that question, what was the point of this piece? I'll ask him other questions, and I've been asking people to help me with those questions. You know, on Twitter, there were some very forthright voices from some very respected people. I listened to those voices. You could get the sense on Twitter that there was unanimity and that there was like a total consensus that Indigenous voices felt like this should by no means happen. I do not purport to speak for Indigenous people, and I don't think anybody could. There is not one opinion. There are many different opinions. What I can tell listeners is that there are Indigenous people who want this scrutiny and accountability to take place. They're, you know, putting a lot of faith in me that I could do a decent job of it and helping me to understand the issues. I'll do my best.
You're familiar with genocide denial. That's something that you've in your own community that you've experienced. I think that you have some sensitivities where it comes to this, but of course it is outside of your experience. So I guess I was just going to say, don't fuck it up.
Thanks, Danny. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. Danny, news stories. There are so many of them. Some slip through the cracks. We try to duly note the good ones that might otherwise go ignored. Do you have something to share today?
Yeah, so the story I have, like, I certainly couldn't say that it hasn't gotten any attention, but I think that because there are so many news stories, it's easy for something to maybe not be at the top of our list. And so I wanted to bring attention to a recent discussion on sexual assault in the military.
Yeah.
So this story, as I've said, it was on the National. We certainly couldn't say nobody's listening to it. But former Supreme Court Justice Louise Arbour and Catherine Bergeron both have experienced sexual harassment while serving in the military, came up with a report and a recommendation that the military not be the people to actually have, not have the legal system to litigate these issues. And that's a pretty huge claim. You know, this has been like, as well as the year of residential schools, it's been like scandal after scandal about the military and its inability to deal with sexual misconduct.
Yeah, Cherie Suturin did some reporting on this for us. And part of her reporting was that, like, we just keep reporting and we keep reporting. How many Canadian stories can we file under this sort of collective amnesia? And then the proof comes and then we forget the proof. But here we are again. Duly noted. I'd like to duly note that while, as a general rule, I, you know, oppose all forms of bigotry and prejudice on grounds, you know, national or otherwise, I didn't hate to see that everybody's ganging up on Sweden.
I was really scared where this was going.
It's about time somebody came for the Swedes. I don't know if listeners caught Swedengate, but the internet turned on Sweden. I love the flattening of the world where just like weird shit in different cultures just gets like held up to international scrutiny. And it began on Reddit, as awful things often do, when somebody asked, what is the weirdest thing you've had to do at somebody else's house because of their culture or religion? That could have gone into all kinds of nasty places. But the place that it went was somebody wrote that the weirdest thing that happened to them was they slept over at a friend's house. When we woke up, he said he's going downstairs for a few minutes. After 15 minutes, I go on the stairs to see what the fuck is happening, and they're eating breakfast. They see me and tell me he's almost done and will be up there soon. I still think about that shit 25 years later. And then person after person confirmed that if you go to a Swede's house for a play date as a child, their parents will not feed you. This is normal in Sweden. They won't feed visiting children. In fact, people had stories of all kinds of scenarios where Swedes won't feed guests. Don't expect a meal if you go over to a Swede's house, those Swedes. They won't feed you. And, you know, Swedes defended themselves that this is actually about politeness, you know. This is about thrift and this is about economizing. And, you know, that kid's parents might have dinner planned for him at home. You don't want to spoil their appetite. And others said, no, I'm Swedish and I can tell you it's because we're parsimonious and withholding and ungenerous.
Stingy bastards.
Stingy. Oh, my God. Danny, shame on you. I wouldn't go that far. I don't know what the truth of this is, but it was amusing and fun. And then, of course, more serious people stepped in and said, yeah, you're all having a laugh. Let me tell you some other things about Swedes. And of course, Sweden, like every country on earth, has a horrible racist history that got much more dark and serious. And it's very similar to when people make Canada jokes and somebody's got some stupid news story about maple syrup or a moose. And then some unfeeling scold has to step in and be like, I know this is all trivial for you, but like actually some serious shit went down in Canada. It's interesting seeing this from the other perspective. I just wanted a good clean laugh at the expense of Swedes. I didn't want to necessarily be embroiled in the dark history of Swedish racism, but I learned new things. So I want to duly note Swedengate. Go check it out.
You know, the last time I was here, we had talked about the capitalist NFTs, and you said, Danny, duly noted is about bringing attention to stories that deserve more attention. So I'm just going to throw that one back to you. Duly noted.
Excellent. All right, Danny, last week, a major report was released into the mental health of Canadian media workers. It's called the Taking Care Report, a report on mental health, well-being, and trauma among Canadian media workers. It was led by the Canadian Journalism Forum on Violence and Trauma, partnership with Carleton University, a professor at Carleton named Matthew Pearson, working with Dave Seglins, who I know, a veteran CBC broadcaster. And this was like a pretty major piece of research. They looked into survey responses from over 1,200 media workers in Canada. And turns out we're all doing great. Everybody's fine.
What a relief.
Yeah, yeah. I guess this was didn't have legs for a full segment. Sorry, everybody. No, that's not what they found. No, we're not okay. The mental health symptoms of Canadian media workers are far above Canadian averages. 69% of us report anxiety, 46% of us depression, 15% PTSD, exacerbated, of course, by the pandemic, repeatedly covering stories related to trauma, not having the appropriate supports, not having supportive colleagues and supervisors who care about journalists, media workers' well-being or the expertise to help them emotionally. Also, of course, facing online harassment, other things. And of course, these symptoms are felt most acutely by women and BIPOC journalists and media workers. Not shocking stuff, but quantified, right? Proven demonstrably. What do you think?
Yeah, it's challenging when these stories come out because, of course, then media is forced with reporting on itself, and that's a little bit of navel gazing. We are probably the people who are most likely to care the most about these stories. If you know reporters, we have a tendency to only hang out with other journalists. Journalists hang out with journalists. No one else likes us. These things weren't really shocking. Well, right? Like, that's just what happens over the years, is like the people that understand you the most are the people who do the job. And if you have like a spouse or friends who aren't involved in journalism, you try and tell them one of your boring journalist stories and they're just like, okay.
Oh, no, you don't have to explain this to me. I'm familiar with the terrain.
But it's not just us, Jesse. I'm explaining to the listener.
It's true. They're here too. Yeah, let's make it like we're not people you want to have over.
Unless you like really boring FOI stories or graphic details of crime and like really off-color humor.
And just such a painful level of self-regard and self-importance and just like, oh, my source is texting. Oh, this is more important than what's happening here. And let me just go on and on with feverish, like, you know, obsession about my work and I don't care about yours. Like, we're the worst. We're the worst.
So one of the things that really stuck with me was that 85% of journalists and media workers have never received training on mental health and trauma. That's a pretty big deal. You also have 46% report higher risks of drinking and 26% are heavy drinkers. I mean, I was like, oh, only 26%? It's not like a very health conscious industry, right? At the same time, there was a really interesting article by Nadine Youssef from the Toronto Star again. She's the mental health reporter talking about CBC's Colin Butler being diagnosed with PTSD and having to fight to have his work-related PTSD recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that really does highlight the problem. And as like a media boss yourself, I think it's good to be aware of these things and good to think about the impact of stories on the people that work for you, even if they don't think of it themselves. And maybe now when I teach journalism students, I do talk to them about trauma, but certainly no one's ever talked to me about trauma. You know, you went in mm-hmm. and it was a part of the job, and that wasn't like 15 years ago or anything. I'm only 34. So this is an abrupt change, I think, to start talking about this.
Yes. And actually, we're both in leadership positions, you to educate people about this and me to, you know, a lot of this is about not having the adequate supports and not having, you know, managers who have the expertise and I don't. So, you know, somebody here should, or, you know, somebody who helps us should. I take two views of this. Personally speaking, I have been aware of this issue of, you know, PTSD amongst journalists and mental health amongst journalists as a topic. You know, you would hear like people who report from conflict zones with PTSD, and I, you know, try to listen and cover those types of accounts, and hearing about the type of stresses that women and BIPOC journalists face, try to be open and listen. But it was never something that I really related to personally, you know, anxiety, stress, mental health of journalists, until the pandemic. And then, yeah, something in the kind of like firewall between that which I cover and the conflicts that I'm involved in and the stresses of the job, like the wall became permeable and, you know, developed anxiety stuff. It's real. Like you can only kind of sequester that stuff or keep it in some silo from the rest of your psyche for so long, and coming to a greater understanding of like, this is real. And so, you know, I'm kind of open to this kind of research and then the, you know, news stories covering it. And then, as you say, Danny, on the other hand, I'm like, are we really going to write stories about how anxious we are and depressed we are to an audience that kind of hates us a lot of the time? And like to an audience who we do damage to, some like it is damaging to people's mental well-being to be misrepresented by the media. And, you know, a lot of people feel that way and they are not really there for stories about how tough our jobs are. It's not that this has to be on the front page of the newspaper every day, but maybe it's something that like we shouldn't feel embarrassed to talk about or deal with or to joke about. Like, I guess the common thing is where we started, you and I, on this is like we joke about like, you know, journalists can only marry other journalists and I'm on my third marriage and we're all hard drinking. And like it's something that we regarded through humor and jokes for, I think, decades and decades.
Yes, like it's certainly known. I don't think that people view the journalist lifestyle as like overly healthy. I think there was another report, something along the lines of like we were all dehydrated and didn't drink enough water. And so it's good to see health. I think you can still integrate health into a workplace, even if it's journalism. You know, camaraderie is important, making sure that the team is working in unity, that they're respectful of one another and notice the impacts of deadlines on each other. Like, and maybe this will help solve that, is that a lot of people who are in journalism have only ever been in journalism. And so they don't know mm-hmm. what other offices or other places do to help deal with similar problems. Not necessarily the same, but like, let's say the medical field is obviously highly stressful. You know, dentists have a very high suicide rate. There's certainly other people that have stress and trauma in their jobs, and we can learn from what other places are doing. And I think that that's important. I suppose in some ways, reporting on it is a bit of accountability. You know, if you report on it, then that makes your organization culpable if there's something going on at your newsroom and nobody's helping you with it. So that is a good thing for Canada Land.
Yeah. Look, I'm, you know, constantly involved in the practice of painting a bullseye on myself. And, you know, Bell did this with Let's Talk Mental Health. It's like, okay, Bell, let's talk mental health. And we've published a number of stories about what's going on at Bell. Look, it's not self-important to regard that you're having trouble. You know, it's not any kind of indulgence to recognize that the tough stuff that we deal with gets in there and can harm us. Yes to this is dumb. Of course, yes. Like this should be discussed and regarded and dealt with. So,
all right.
That's Shortcuts for this week. Danny, thank you for joining me.
Happy to be here.
We're on Twitter at Canada Land. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything people send. Danny Parody, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Danny Parody if you have to.
This episode's produced by Aviva Lessard with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Kieran Oudshorn. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. It is like the last moments of our annual sale, so if you would like to receive ad-free versions of all of our podcasts at a ridiculously low price, you're going to have to wait a year to get them at this price again. So go right now to canadaland.com/join or hit the link in the show notes. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.